Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My name is Molly McLaughlin, and I own a company that optimizes sleep through technology, accountability, and behavioral change. Each week, I'll be interviewing world-class experts ranging from doctors, innovators, and thought leaders to give actionable tips and strategies that you can implement to become a more skillful sleeper. Let's jump into your dose of practical sleep training. Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My guest today is Nir Eyal, and he is a rock star in the area of human behavior. Now, when we're prioritizing sleep, it's really a big deal in the 21st century because how do we become indistractable when we get hooked on so many gadgets and gizmos throughout the day? Now, my guest literally wrote the book on both of these topics. These books have made a profound difference in my life personally, and it was actually just such an incredible experience to get to interview such a tremendous thought leader in the area of behavioral change. One of the biggest problems that many of my clients at Sleep as a Skill face is how to manage their days in such a way that they feel that they can truly be off and relax in the evenings. In this episode, we will explore exactly how to become indistractable so that you can honor your word to yourself to show up, as Nir puts it, to be available for sleep at the time you said you would consistently. And beyond that, when you get into that bed at the time you said, have you managed your day in such a way that you have that peace of mind to be fully at ease in the activity that you're doing, with the goal being sleeping? So a little bit about our guest. Nir Eyal writes, consults, and teaches about the intersection of psychology, technology, and business. Nir previously taught as a lecturer in marketing at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He co-founded and sold two tech companies since 2003 and was dubbed by MIT Technology Review as the, quote, prophet of habit-forming technology. He is the author of two best-selling books, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. Indistractable specifically received critical acclaim, including the Outstanding Works of Literature Award, as well as being named as one of the best business and leadership books of the year by Amazon and one of the best personal development books of the year by Audible. The Globe and Mail called Indistractable the best business book of 2019. Now, in addition to blogging on Near and Far, Nir's writing has been featured in the New York Times, the Harvard Business Review, Time Magazine, and Psychology Today. Nir is also an active investor in habit-forming technology. Some of his past investments include Eventbrite, Anchor.fm, Product Hunt, Marco Polo, 7 Cups, Refresh.io, Focusmate, and Shadow. Nir attended the Stanford Graduate School of Business and Emory University. So let's jump in because this guy's got a lot to share with us that we can really learn in the area of habit formation and behavioral change and apply it really today and into your night on how to improve your sleep. And welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. I am so excited to have you here today. Thank you so much for taking the time, particularly on the other side of the globe right now.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yes. No, I cannot wait to dive in with you on this topic. Your books have made a big difference in my life. And certainly as it relates to my own journey with my sleep and then working with clients around their ability to transform this area for themselves. So I would love to kind of start at the beginning of one, how did you become known in this arena, both as having such awareness of what it takes, what these kind of gadgets and gizmos, how the stickiness effect of them, and how you have such knowledge there. And then on the flip side, how you've been able to kind of make a transformation in your own life to bring about an awareness of how to maybe not fall lockstep into the use of those.
Sure. Yeah. So I taught for many years at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and then later at the Hasso-Plattner Institute of Design, where I taught classes on how to build the kind of products and services that use consumer psychology principles and behavioral design to get people hooked. And in fact, that was the title of my first book. It was called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. And to some people, that might sound sinister, but actually, if you read the book, it's really about how do we build the kind of products and services that can help people build good habits in their life. It wasn't for Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. They didn't need my book. I actually stole their secrets so that we could build products and services to help people exercise more. For example, Fitbod is a, a client of mine that uses the Hooked model to get people hooked to exercise. Kahoot, was the largest educational company in the world today, uses the Hooked model to get kids hooked onto online learning. So there's all kinds of ways we can use these consumer psychology principles for good. But of course, the flip side is that sometimes they are used in a way that makes us want to overuse these products. And so my follow-up book was titled Indistractable, and that just came out recently. And Indistractable is all about how to control your attention and choose your life. And so given that I know so much about how to build habits, I also know a lot about how to break bad habits. And so I really delve into the deeper psychology of why do we get distracted? Why don't we do what we say we're going to do? And how do we make sure that we can control this most precious commodity of our time and our attention so that we can decide our life?
Wow. Yeah. And I really, particularly from your book, Indistractable, I loved your vulnerability in sharing your own story of, oh my goodness, I am just, I'm having a moment where I clearly am addicted to, or, you know, using this, being used by this item, or, you know, I think in your case, it was with your phone or what have you. So relatable to virtually any person in the 21st century, largely, certainly Western society. And what you've been able to do is kind of create this roadmap for many people on how to control our attention and really be, you know, put back in the driver's seat of our lives. And this is a big, big area as it relates to sleep, because what seems to happen time and time again is people want to make a difference in their sleep. They say, you know, okay, we're going to prioritize this. I'm going to have this great plan. My new bedtime is this time. I'm going to wind down X time. And so the sun sets, you know, we have this great ambition, and yet suddenly we've missed that goal time. And exactly what you said, we're not, you know, hitting what we originally said we would do. And now we're upset about it and, you know, react in whatever way we react, but it has a snowball effect. So I would love to hear more from you too, because you have so many great principles throughout your book of ways that we can begin to gain back that control, particularly, you know, in those evening hours, and how to choose the prioritization of sleep and get hooked on that concept, you know, versus being at the effect of our gadgets.
Yeah. And you know, I wrote Indistractable thinking the big challenge was about technology distraction. And, you know, I wrote this book for me more than anyone else, because I've never had a lot of self-control. I've never had a lot of willpower. And I found that I was incredibly distracted. I mean, it took me 5 years to write this book because I kept getting distracted every time I wrote it.
I loved that.
And so I wrote this book, you know, not because I knew the answer, but because I was searching for the answer. And what I was so surprised to find is that there, you know, I had so many misconceptions and myths bouncing around my head that were really harming me, in that it changed my behavior in so many negative ways that I didn't realize. You know, the book is full of all kinds of myth busting around our behaviors. And so it's really, you know, in the time that I've written this book and the research I did leading up to it over the past 5 years, it has changed every area of my life. I used to be completely obese. Today, I'm in the best shape of my life at age 42. I've never been in better shape.
Wow.
I get better sleep than ever before. My relationship with my wife, we've been married for 18 years. We've never been closer. My daughter and I are closer than ever. All because I simply do what I say I'm going to do. And I think this is really the skill of the century, that today, you know, the world is more distractible than ever. That if you don't decide how you want to spend your time and attention, you better believe someone's going to decide for you, whether it's the media company, whether it's, you know, the news, whether it's technology, whether it's your job, your kids, you name it, somebody is going to claim your time and attention unless you decide for yourself how you're going to spend it. You know, there's a reason we call it paying attention. We pay attention just like we pay with dollars and cents. And just as we wouldn't stand on a street corner and give everyone who wants our money, you know, a $100 bill and a $10 bill, a $20 bill, we wouldn't just hand it out to whoever wants it. We're judicious about who we pay and how we spend our money. And so the same needs to happen for our time, because unlike money, you can always make more money, right? But even Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos have the same 24 hours per day. It doesn't matter how rich you are, you get the same 24 hours. And so it's even more important that we understand how to spend our time and our attention in a way that serves us as opposed to the people who are trying to capture those limited resources. And so I think the best place to start perhaps is by understanding what is distraction, because I think that's one of those things I really did not understand, really, what is distraction. It sounds like something everybody thinks they know what it is, but I'd like to press that a little bit and test that. So the best way I think of understanding what distraction is to understand what distraction is not. So if you think to yourself, what is the opposite of distraction? Most people will tell you the opposite of distraction is focus, but that's not exactly right. That in fact, if you look at the origin of the word, the opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction.
Yes.
That both words come from the same Latin root, trahere, which means to pull, and they both end in the same six letters, A-C-T-I-O-N, that spells action. So traction, by definition, is any action that pulls you towards what you say you're going to do, things that you do with intent, things that are in accordance with your values and help you become the kind of person you want to become. Those are acts of traction. The opposite traction is distraction. Distraction is any action that pulls you away from what you plan to do, anything that is not done with intent, anything that pulls you away from your values and pulls you away from becoming the kind of person you want to become. So this isn't just semantics. This is actually really important, because I would argue that anything can be either traction or distraction. The difference between traction and distraction is one word, and that one word is forethought. So, you know, these days we hear a lot about how technology is addicting us and technology is hijacking our brains and scrolling social media is bad for you. And God forbid you should play a video game, that the algorithms are manipulating your mind. And that's total rubbish. Look, I know it's rubbish because I wrote the book Hooked. I know every trick in the book. I wrote the book. And I can tell you that the techniques are good, but they're not that good. And in fact, we have to stop demonizing the technology, because that is not the problem. All it does is make people feel guilty and shameful about wonderful tools that, if they use appropriately, can benefit them. So I'm not one of these academics who sits in their ivory tower and says, oh, stop using social media, stop checking email.
Yeah.
You know, easier said than done. Many of us, our jobs require us to use these tools.
Right.
And why should we? I mean, can you imagine trying to go through this pandemic without these technologies? If this hit us during the 80s or 90s, we would have really been screwed, because how would we connect with other people? So thank goodness we have these technologies. So it's not that I would say stop using these technologies. It's about using them with intent, using them with forethought, because anything can be traction. As long as you plan for those things, it's traction. And I think conversely, anything that you do just because it has, you know, an air of moral superiority can also be distraction. For example, how many people do we know that work nonstop, even when they intend to be with their family or get sleep or do something else or exercise, they're constantly working, even though that's, you know, what society tells you is the productive thing to do. It can just as much be a distraction if it pulls you away from being the kind of person you want to become and living out your values. So anything can be traction, anything can be distraction. The difference is forethought and intent. So I think that's a really, really important distinction.
Oh, I'm so glad you pointed that out, because that was a very huge aha moment for me when reading about that in your book, because it's just, it's one of the things that it had me immediately do. This is so simple, but so obvious, but in the moment, I literally changed around my phone and got rid of so many things that were distracting me away from my pull and the things that, you know, I actually did want to gain traction in. So just simplifying the apps on the iPhone, I know that's such a basic thing, but it really spurred action from the words on your page. You know, it was just really incredible. And I know you go into great detail in the book too about really parsing that out and how people can make that actionable, and certainly not semantics. And in alignment with that, I'm wondering if you can also share more with us about, I loved how you called this book, particularly Indistractable, kind of a Mythbusters. And one of the myths that you bust is willpower. And I'm wondering if you could share more about like this idea that it's finite.
Yeah. So there's a popular notion in the psychology community, or used to be, it's certainly still in folk psychology, that willpower is a limited resource.
Right.
That willpower is something that we run out of. this has a name. It was called ego depletion. And there was a psychologist who got a lot of notoriety kind of spreading this idea. And then what happens in the social sciences, if an idea, if an experiment sounds a little too good to be true, we rerun the experiment to see if it replicates. And unfortunately, other psychologists found that it doesn't look like the effect is real, that willpower doesn't seem to run out, at least not in the way you would think that it runs out like a, you know, gas in a gas tank. It doesn't work that way. That in fact, the only people who did experience ego depletion, the only people who really do run out of willpower the way you would run out of gas in a gas tank, are people who believe that willpower is a finite resource.
The nocebo effect.
Exactly, that we conform to our beliefs. And we see this so frequently. I mean, this really changed my mind and my life in so many ways, because we hear people labeling themselves all the time in such unproductive ways. You know, I have a short attention span. I'm a morning person. Not a morning person. I have an addictive personality. This is just the way I am. These are all constructs in our brain. And in fact, you know, sometimes I actually talk about how an identity can serve you, how, you know, the reason I called the book Indistractable is because we know that having a moniker can actually make you conform to that belief in a good way. So for example, if you call yourself a vegan, when you wake up in the morning, chances are you're not going to say, should I have some bacon for breakfast or not? You don't do that because it is who you are. It's your identity. So in many ways, an identity can serve us. But in many ways, when we have these self-limiting beliefs based on a spurious identity, such as, you know, I have a short attention span or an addictive personality or whatever it is that we tell ourselves we are, it becomes so. And I think that is perfectly demonstrated with this ego depletion idea. If you believe, oh, I'm spent, I have no more willpower, I had such a hard day today at work, give me that pint of Ben and Jerry's, I'm going to sit on the couch and watch Netflix. Well, you'll do that because you believe that you are what you say you are.
I'm so glad you kind of parsed it out like that, because that's one of the biggest places that I find we have to begin for a transformation in sleep. You know, that's the reason we called sleep as a skill, because to kind of reframe the conversation instead of coming at to the table with, well, I'm a night owl, well, I'm this, that, and the other, I'm an insomniac, I'm, you know, having all of these labels and how much that can impact what's possible to really shift a lot of the behaviors that go into creating something new. So what you're speaking to, I think, is so profound. And it certainly also relates to the pragmatics of throughout the day, because so much of sleep and prioritizing sleep does become around time management and allocating proper amounts of time and energy and attention to just ensuring that you make it happen.
Yeah, it's such a, it, you know, sleep is such a great demonstration of so many cognitive quirks. I mean, one of the studies that I think is particularly relevant and really blew my mind were these studies that they did around people. You're probably familiar with this, so stop me if you know it already, but where they did these studies where they let people sleep in a lab and they told them they had very poor sleep that night, even though they didn't. They had, you know, they connected them to, they monitored their sleep patterns and they had a wonderful night's sleep, but they told them you had a very poor night's sleep. And of course, how did they behave throughout the day? They behaved, you know, they thought they were groggy. They thought they didn't have a very good night's sleep. And in fact, their behavior reflected it as such. They actually, you know, they when they did these self-reported surveys on how do you feel, how aware, how alert are you, how sleepy are you, they reported exactly what you would expect if they had had a terrible night's sleep when they didn't. They had a great night's sleep. And then they reversed the experiment. They made sure that people did not have a good night's sleep. They only let them get very light sleep that was not very deep sleep. They didn't let them go into REM sleep. And then they told them when they woke up, actually, you had a wonderful night's sleep. And guess what? They conform to that as well. So our expectations and our beliefs, you know, this is part of the, you know, I experiment a lot with behavior change technologies, and I have pretty much every sleep monitor and health monitor device. I love to test them. And one of the things that I found that is actually an unexpected benefit of some of these tracking devices, I think there are some downsides for sure. I don't think they're perfect. But one of the upsides is that you only remember when you are awake. Right, you only remember the interruptions at night. But what I was so surprised to find is that, you know, many times I wake up and I say, oh, that was a horrible night's sleep. And then I look at my sleep tracker and the sleep tracker said, actually, you had a great night's sleep. But I wouldn't have known that because I got up three times last night. That means I had a horrible night's sleep. I didn't sleep at all last night. Well, no, I only was up for 15 minutes, but that's all I remember out of a 7-8 hour night.
I love that too. Yeah, because sleep is such a cool area in that we can quickly get foggy about the specifics. So when we do have an external element that can provide a bit more, you know, metrics to the conversation, that can really shift things. I love that.
There's another part of in the book, I talk about the importance of scheduling, which I know you're a big fan of as well in terms of planning your time. And I think, you know, for me, one of the things that I think really changed my life is that I stopped being a hypocrite. With my daughter, with my child. I would tell her, you know, you have a bedtime, you need to get to bed on time because the science says that children need quality sleep. And then I would stay up on social media or checking email or watching something on Netflix, and I didn't have my own bedtime. And I realized one day what a hypocrite I was being by not having my own bedtime. And that's completely changed. And then I think, you know, another thing that I struggle with was, okay, you plan the bedtime, which is so important, not just for sleep, but, you know, planning out what you want to do with your time. And I talk about this in the book in terms of how you turn your values into time, whether it's for physical health, whether it's for relationships, whether it's for your work, whatever it is, we've got to start planning our time as opposed to thinking that we can run our day off of a to-do list. That's another myth I bust, is that to-do lists, it turns out, are horrible for your productivity. Not many people realize this. I certainly didn't. But, you know, running your day by looking at your to-do list is a wonderful way to never get everything done. I don't know anybody who keeps a to-do list and runs their day with a to-do list who gets everything they say they're going to do done. And yet we keep using this broken system. So that's something I talk about. But one of the things that I struggled with was, look, I planned the time, right? I did what the experts say. I set an implementation intention and I said, okay, I'm going to be in bed at this time and I'm going to get to sleep. But then, even though I planned that I would do that, sleep didn't come, right? I would wake up and now I'm rolling around in bed and I can't go to sleep. And what's going on? I said I was going to do this and now I'm not. What do I do? And this gets back to, I think, a really, really important point around where distraction comes from. And you'll see how this relates to sleep in just a minute.
Yes.
Because, you know, when we think about distraction, we think about external triggers. External triggers are the pings, the dings, the rings, all of the things that can take us off track, that can lead us towards distraction rather than traction. And of course, it's very, very important that we do what I call hack back those external triggers, like you talked about earlier, changing your notification settings, not sleeping next to your cell phone, making sure that there's nothing that beeps or boops in your bedroom, you know, very important, but that's kind of kindergarten stuff. That's of course, very, very basic. Everybody should do that. There's no excuse. Like, you know, if you don't adjust your notification settings so that you're not constantly interrupted all night and put your phone in another room when you sleep, you know, that's kind of step one. But it turns out that the leading cause of distraction is not the external triggers. If you look at why people get distracted, it's not the external triggers as the number one source. The number one source of distraction is, in fact, the internal triggers. That distraction tends to not begin from outside of us, but rather distraction begins from within us. Internal triggers are uncomfortable emotional states that we seek to escape from. It's boredom, loneliness, fatigue, stress, anxiety, these uncomfortable sensations. This is the root cause of procrastination and distraction. It's not a character flaw. There's nothing wrong with you. What it means simply is that you don't have the tools to deal with emotional discomfort in an adaptive, healthy way that leads you towards traction rather than distraction. So for example, back to sleep, you know, I would go to bed and say, okay, I've got the blackout shades, you know, I'm not sleeping next to my cell phone. I'm charging it outside so that nothing interrupts me and I'm in bed on time and I'm not sleeping, right? I would wake up night after night at 3 a.m. Every night, 3 a.m., I'd wake up and I wouldn't be able to get back to sleep. And worst of all, and I'm sure, many of your listeners, I'm sure, are aware of this, you start getting into this rumination cycle of, I'm not sleeping. And tomorrow, that means tomorrow's shot. And if I don't get to sleep soon, I'm gonna not have a productive day tomorrow. And things are going to be awful. And then this rumination cycle would, of course, keep me up even longer and longer, sometimes for hours. And then I found a wonderful technique to deal with that internal trigger. Essentially, what I was doing was triggering myself. This rumination cycle was triggering more anxiety. And then I found a wonderful way to disarm that anxiety. And the solution for me was a simple mantra. And the mantra that I repeat whenever I get up at 3 a.m., and this is very important, I skipped this part, that your job when you schedule a task, for example, like sleep, is not to finish the task. It's not to do the task. It's to make yourself available with your full intention, your full presence, to enable yourself to do whatever it is you said you're going to do. So I did my part. I got my body into bed on time. Whether sleep comes or not, that's not necessarily in my control. So what I started doing was to repeat a simple mantra, which is the body gets what the body needs. The body gets what the body needs. And by simply repeating that mantra, I was disarming this rumination loop of anxiety and telling myself, look, if I didn't get really good sleep tonight, I'll get good sleep tomorrow. Because there was kind of like this you know, phase. If I had a terrible night's sleep and maybe only get, you know, 3 or 4 hours one night, the next night, I'd make up for it. I'd get a really good night's sleep. And my tracking devices actually showed that I would go, if I had a bad night's sleep one night, I'd go straight into deep sleep the next night and sleep longer. And so this mantra of telling myself the body gets what the body needs, the body gets what the body needs, made me relax, stop the rumination cycle, stop the anxiety. And you know where this story ends, of course. I got to sleep, right? Because I could disarm that cycle.
Oh, I love how you phrase it too, because making yourself available, I haven't heard it put in that way. I've heard of people talking about a sleep opportunity and ensuring that they create a sleep opportunity for themselves of 8, 9 hours, what have you. But this idea of fulfilling on your word and doing what you said and making yourself available is such a great way to put it, because as we know, we can't force sleep, but we can put the structures in place to set ourselves up powerfully for consistency. So that's wonderful.
I think it actually applies to other areas of our life as well. So for example, when I do my writing, I can't summon the muse, right? I can't snap my fingers and say, okay, now I'm going to write a Pulitzer Prize winning essay. I can't do that, right? But if I don't sit my butt in this chair and make myself available for the good ideas to come, then they're definitely not going to happen. It's the same with our relationships, right? I can't plan time with my daughter and insist that we have a bonding moment. I can't do that. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But if I don't plan the time and protect that time and keep it sacred and make myself available for those good things to happen, if I don't set that time aside, for sure they're not going to happen.
Oh, that's so true. And actually that really hits home for me. I have to really double down on a lot of my writing for this upcoming new course. And so thank you for sharing that. I will be practicing that immediately. And I know also in the book, one of the things that you speak to is this conversation around identity packs. And I'm wondering if we could parse that out a little bit and how that can relate to our identity around our sleep and what could be possible for people by utilizing that kind of method.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this goes back a little bit to what we were talking about before in terms of how identities can sometimes serve us and sometimes they can hurt us. So we want to ask ourselves which of those identities are serving us in our life and how can we use this psychology in a way that really does help us. And so just as we wouldn't, you know, I preach against having these self-limiting beliefs, I also think that we can use that very same psychology to help us conform to the kind of people we want to become. And this actually comes from the psychology of religion, that we know that when someone calls themselves a devout Muslim or an observant Christian or whatever the case might be, they don't have to debate with themselves around doing certain things. It is just who they are. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's something very similar that can be done around distraction and doing anything that we say we are going to do with our time and our attention, whether that's to get proper rest, whether it's being with our family when we say we will, whether it's doing focused work or writing or whatever it is that we say we're going to do, that utilizing that kind of identity can help us do those things, particularly when I think as a culture, we are struggling with how these devices fit into our lives. And I think the good news is, the reason I'm so optimistic is that I think we've been here before with a technology that was in fact much more addictive than what we face on our smartphones. And I'm talking about cigarettes. I remember when I was growing up, you know, in the early 1980s, I remember in my household, we had ashtrays all over our house. Now, my parents didn't smoke. My father had given it up years before. And I remember we had ashtrays, though, still. And everybody I knew actually had ashtrays. It's kind of hard to remember now. If you were born after this period, this seems totally weird to you. But back then, everybody had ashtrays in their house, whether you smoked or not. Why? Because when someone came to your house, the social norm was that if they wanted to smoke, they didn't ask. They just lit up a cigarette and you had to provide them an ashtray. That was what life looked like back then. Hmm. And then people started changing. And I remember the first time that my mom told a friend who had come over and took out a pack of cigarettes and immediately started to light her cigarette, my mom told her friend, she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. We are non-smokers." You see the identity here? Yeah. We are non-smokers. If you would like to smoke, if you'd be so kind as to go outside. And let me tell you, the first time she did this, her friend was so offended. "You're going to ask me to go outside to smoke?" This was very strange. But of course, today, can you imagine somebody right. would come over to your house and just smoke a cigarette without asking you? That's ridiculous. That's incredibly rude. You'd kick them out.
Right.
But what changed? Was it that some kind of law was passed to restrict people from smoking in private residence? No, there's never been such a law. What changed was that people like my mother stood up and said, "No, this isn't a good thing for us, right? This is not part of who I am. This is not the kind of family I want to raise." And she just asked that person to change their behavior and do what they wanted to do outside. And so that's what being indistractable is partially about. It's about having an identity for yourself that I think can make change throughout the world. That by showing people, you know what? Yeah, I'm indistractable. That means I do things that are a little bit different. Just like how my mom did a few things a little bit different when it came to smoking. Yeah, that means I keep a schedule. That means I have a bedtime. That means I do some different things in my life than maybe everyone else does. But is that so different from someone who has an unusual vegan diet or someone who wears unusual religious garb? No, we make accommodations in society for those people. And sometimes those people help influence others, just like my mom did with helping people that she knew know that it's socially inappropriate to smoke in certain contexts. So I'm hoping that that identity of becoming indistractable is something that people will describe themselves as, is that we can spread what's called social antibodies, that when society realizes that there's an unhealthy behavior, that we can actually inoculate ourselves from that behavior by socializing good manners. And so we see this already, right? For example, when someone, you know, it checks their phone at the table, when you're out with friends or family or in a business meeting, we see that more and more people are starting to call each other out and say, "Yeah, you know what? I really want to be fully present with you right now." Or a good practices such as, you know, not sleeping next to your cell phone, right? That, hey, you know what? During a certain time of day, I'm indistractable. That's who I am. And I think that type of norm is something that I think we all can help spread so that it becomes something that maybe someday in my dream, it's not unusual. It becomes the new norm.
Mm. Oh my gosh. I love that. I share in that goal, particularly, you know, certainly applying that concept, you know, of course, in this conversation around sleep with there's so many behaviors that we're looking to have people bring about to strengthen their circadian rhythm throughout the daytime hours that to fit them in throughout their day. So for example, you know, getting outside and getting morning sunlight can really help with our circadian rhythm to do routinely. And something like that might just be finding a window, like a time block of an extra, say like 20 minutes of a new habit that many people are not used to doing and how to make that become a regular thing for them. And so I love what you're speaking to around this idea of taking on this identity, because I think that that can help orient people and pull them towards that new behavioral change. I know you also speak in the book to, I love that you call out BJ Fogg, such an amazing thinker on this area, and you speak to his BMAT, you know, so as it relates to really this behaviors, motivation, ability, and triggers. And I'm wondering if that's something that you see that we could also apply in this conversation throughout the management of our days to ensure that we prioritize just kind of that winding down, calming period in the evening to induce or make that sleep availability possible.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so Fogg is I'm sort of a disciple of his and his work, and so he had a wonderful formula for describing what's necessary for any given behavior. And so Fogg says that any behavior requires three things at the same time. We need sufficient motivation, ability, and a trigger. And so the big insight here is actually that you know, to get to the kind of the punchline here, is that motivation is actually a lot less important than we tend to think.
Yeah.
That we tend to think that we don't do things because, oh, you must not want it enough. You don't have enough willpower. You don't have enough self-control. And it turns out that motivation is not typically, for most behaviors, the limiting factor. I mean, think about it common sense-wise. We all want to lose weight. We all want to live healthfully. We all want to get better sleep. We all want to spend more quality time with our family. We know that we want to do these things, and we, in fact, know what to do. The question is, why don't we do them? And I would argue that it's because we get in our own way, that we make things harder than they have to be. And so if you want to change your behavior, don't start with motivation. Start with the second part of B equals M-A-T. The A stands for ability. And ability has to do with how difficult or easy a task is to do. And this comes out of Lewin's equation, which is a psychologist that lived over 100 years ago, who said basically that people act in accordance with their environments, that the easier something is to do, the more likely people are to do it. So if you want to change your behavior, don't try and boost motivation. That actually won't last very long. Make that behavior easier to do, right? That is really the kind of summary of the work, is how can we shape our environment so that the intended behavior doesn't require a lot of effort. And that's something that I was really surprised to find in Indistractable, is that the people who I interviewed who were indistractable, the people who seemed to get more done than anybody else, who had this superhuman ability to not get distracted, they didn't have a lot of willpower and self-control. They weren't particularly, you know, self-disciplined people. That what they had was a system. They had a plan in place. And so I think if you were to summarize Indistractable into one mantra, it's this, and this is what I learned, that the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought. That fundamentally, whenever we don't do what we say we're going to do, whenever we procrastinate or get distracted, it's not a character flaw, it's an impulsivity issue. It's that we don't know how to deal with these urges, these impulses that take us away from what we said we would do. But the good news is that the antidote to impulsiveness is forethought, that there is no impulse that we cannot control if we plan ahead, that if you wait till the last minute, you will lose. If the cigarette is lit in your hand, you're gonna smoke it. If the chocolate cake is on the fork on the way to your mouth, you're gonna eat it. If you sleep next to your cell phone, you're gonna check it in the middle of the night. It's too late, you already lost. However, if you take steps in advance, if you think about this stuff, if you use forethought to make sure that you don't get distracted when the time comes, this is how we use this principle to make sure that our distractions don't get the best of us, that we lead ourselves towards traction rather than distraction.
Oh, so well said. There's just so much wisdom that you have to share. It's insane. So for anyone listening, absolutely get anything that Nir puts out as far as both, you know, with his books that he's put out there, you know, signing up for more around him. So maybe this would be a great time for you to share. How can people begin to make sure that they follow you? Because I know that just by listening to you, we're getting just a smidgen of all that is available in what you've put out there. So what are some of the best ways that they can stay connected with you and learn more?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Yeah, so the best place to find me is on my blog. It's called nirandfar.com. Nir is spelled like my first name, so it's N-I-R and far.com. And actually, I want to let your listeners know that I made a workbook that went along with Indistractable. Unfortunately, the book got too long and we had to take the workbook out. However, it's available totally free on my website. If you just go to nirandfar.com, there's an 80-page a complimentary workbook that can help get you started to become indistractable. And I hope you go check that out. Again, that's at nirandfar.com. And the book, again, is called Indistractable: How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life.
Oh my goodness. So great. Definitely get his books. They are game changers. And I just really appreciate you taking the time on the other side of the globe to have this conversation with us today. Really made a difference.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Sleep is a Skill podcast, the number one podcast for people who want to take their sleep skills to the next level. Every Monday, I send out something that I call Molly's Monday Obsessions, containing everything that I'm obsessing over in the world of sleep. Head on over to sleepisaskill.com to sign up.